You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, as European leaders prepare to gather in Brussels tomorrow, we'll ask in what direction the bloc is headed and will Angela Merkel and Germany lead the way? My guests, Joy Ladiko and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including...
As long as our voices are heard, as long as everyone here stands up to the tyranny that's occurring in our legislative bodies, democracy will never die and change will occur. Yeah.
As the movement to rid the US of gun violence in schools gathers pace, we'll look at why students, authorities and the government aren't seeing eye to eye. We'll also learn why the military are on the streets in Rio and learning why the appearance and disappearance of an artwork in Madrid is provoking debate. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to today's programme. My guests today are indeed Oscar Guardiola Rivera, reader in international law and international affairs at Birkbeck College, and Joy Ladiko, columnist at the London Evening Standard. Good evening to you both. Good to have you with us here in Studio One. Now, European leaders will gather for an informal summit in Brussels on Friday, aimed at shaping the future of the bloc in turbulent times. But Germany's Angela Merkel has made a head start on the rhetoric. Addressing the German lower house this week, she says Brexit gives the bloc an opportunity to rethink its finances, and also recommended that EU funding be linked to nations' intake of foreign migrants. Germany, she says, can only do well in the long run if Europe does well. Joy Ladiko, this is an interesting one, and it rather prompts you to think that, once again, the UK might have jumped ship at precisely the moment when many of its underlying concerns with the EU may be about to be addressed?
Well, actually, I think that arrived when Macron started taking a much stronger line on posted workers, and he too today has been announced that he's sort of turning over asylum applications at a much faster rate. In a sense, in a sort of in the sort of trio, in the triangle of Germany, France, and Britain, because we've kicked up a fuss for so long, the other two were almost duty bound to say no, no, no. And you're right. I think that the things are changing. I don't think it's just Merkel. I think you know, particularly concerns about migration are coming out very strongly in the Visegrad nations over in the east. So it has finally risen to the top of the agenda. If anything, we perhaps were a little bit early.
Yeah, well, it's not often we say that in the European context. What about this notion of Europe? It's striking when you listen to Merkel, the way she talks about Europe doing well. Europe, it's not an abstract concept in Germany. It's part of the domestic political identity almost as well, for understandable reasons, I suppose. Do you think that the UK, Oscar, continues to misunderstand its neighbours' understanding of what Europe means?
Well, we're certainly misunderstanding that right now. I'm not sure I would have used the term continuous. The UK had a position which, in a certain way, did allow Europe to ask itself some important questions. But now that we're supposedly going solo, you know, we had given up that position of, you know, the consciousness of what Europe could be. And now, of course, that role has to be taken up. And it is being taken up by both Germany and France at a time when Europe is, some might say, ripping itself apart. I mean, there are huge challenges, not just the external ones that Merkel mentioned, but internally. I mean, you have Austria, Hungary and Poland going in a very, very dangerous political direction. Maybe Italy coming right behind. And that kind of division is what is, this is the concrete materiality of Europe's challenges.
And Joy, what about Merkel? Because obviously domestically weakened somewhat. She herself experienced, as we did in the UK, a weakening at the last election. And she's obviously making a significant sort of emotional and political investment in the bloc for understandable reasons. Can Germany be a more sort of assertive presence within Europe, given that her domestic position is perhaps less stable than it's been for some time?
That's a very good question, actually, as to how it casts itself in the future. I mean, Germany, you know, one of the big things that's coming up is PESCO, is sort of joint security. Now, Germany typically would not take much of a lead on that sort of thing. So Merkel can't really push herself to the forefront of that. On budgetary, on the budget and the spend and the fact that Germany clearly has a surplus, you know, even within Germany, even they're into the idea of deeper integration, they do all kick up a fuss when they find money going off to the poorer nations they don't feel they've paid back. And I think although she's seen off the AfD, she's not had to form a right-wing alliance, she's doing it with the SPD, I still think that the numbers of people who are not into the idea of deeper integration and more sovereignty, which is about a third, will form a, you know, particular drag on this particular phase of her leadership.
Hmm. And Oscar, how does that play? We mentioned this sort of, you know, Germany, France and the UK, obviously the UK departing. Was there sort of healthy competition between Germany and France? I guess it's always been there. Does it matter who, indeed, if anyone does attempt to position themselves as the sort of de facto leader of the bloc, once it's down to just the 27?
I mean, as we heard before, Macron took the initiative and then Merkel. And in fact, what you see is a sort of interesting partnership forming there. You could say that Europe is becoming divided into three concentric circles with both France and Germany at the center, then some sort of buffer, and then the outer regions of Europe, which, you know, some might say Europe is self-colonizing, you know, places like Greece and the south of Spain. So it isn't a surprise that you have this sort of partnership at the bottom, precisely because, you know, when the UK was there, you could see a healthier dialogue. There was a more, you know, self-critical attitude. Mm. Now, with the UK going, it's easy to see why they come together and they're going to try and lead Europe. The question is where to. Merkel did mention that, you know, the challenges coming from Asia and Syria. Is it really the case that Europe can take an independent position in foreign affairs when, you know, most people know that the real players are elsewhere, you know, the US, China, and so on and so forth? Unlikely. And then the internal challenges are so huge. So, of course, there needs to be a leader, and I'm not surprised that France and Germany are working together. I don't see a sort of competition there, but it is a shame, I do believe, that the UK has jumped ship. And I think you're right, we may have done so when, you know, it's not no longer needed, if it ever was.
Well, indeed. And to that point about the sort of the imperfections in the Union, Joy, it's interesting. Let's look at this sort of summit meeting tomorrow. What is on the agenda? Obviously, it's understandable that, you know, Brexit will dominate. Well, no, but just in general terms, I mean, people obviously will be interested in talking about the challenges of migration, you know, or is it one of those things where it'll be more interesting to hear what they don't talk about when we sort of look back on the meeting?
Well, you're sort of sitting here on the cusp of, I mean, an argument that's been had ever since the sort of EC, which is how deeply integrated do you want the EU to be? As you said, Macron is leading the push. Merkel is weakened. The East is a rather different situation. Coming up is the next budget, and this is where they have to begin to decide, well, do we want to start moving money around? And, you know, money has a direction, money has a motive. How much do you want to put into kind of joint defence funds? How much do you actually want to put into structural funds related to where migrants live? And the migrant question is actually, it's a sort of moral question. And if Merkel is actually suggesting this, and if it does get taken up, it really does impinge on the sovereignty of countries like Hungary, who did not want those migrants there. And so she's basically issued a challenge to them. Again, joint security is an impingement on sovereignty. Will she win these arguments? For all we say about, you know, Macron and Merkel leading, there are only two countries. There are 27. There are quite a few there who will, in fact, argue differently and also have an equal weight in those arguments around the table. They have the same size seat.
Yeah, in fact, we're witnessing that tension. You know, Poland, Hungary and others are clearly going in a very different direction.
And although they may not have economies as big, when you start putting the Visegrads together, actually that's quite a substantial bloc who can vote against.
Absolutely. Also for security reasons, and because they are the sort of first points of call when it comes to migration.
Yeah. So, and on security, you know, it's quite interesting, the Russian attempts to befriend Hungary, which then in itself create a different dynamic within the EU, which has always, consistently held this sort of quite firm line against Russia. Well, what happens when elements within it begin to change their attitudes?
Including Germany.
Well, indeed. And just before we move on that sort of more explicitly financial questions, I've got the front page of the Financial Times here today. UK brace for Unilever snub as Netherlands leads race for HQ. There'll be some very immediate, there appear to be some very immediate financial consequences for the United Kingdom join. Again, that was foreseeable, many predicted it, but it's funny the difference that makes when it's the headline of what's happening in the FT rather than a potential op-ed piece about what might happen.
Yeah, well, I think Unilever has been facing a decision about where to headquarter for a while, purely for reasons of efficiency within the company. And it's a long history of actually Anglo-Dutch companies. But Brexit is sort of forcing the question, not just of Unilever, but a number of financial institutions as to what is best for their company, where is the best market. And it will come back, you know, the Dutch have a particularly friendly tax regime, so that helps matters a lot. But you're sitting there, if you're a company boss trying to make a decision, or a board trying to make a decision, money is going to begin to flow, slowly but surely, into the EU and away from the UK. And so there'll be just a sort of little stream of these stories coming out. There won't be one big bang, but you'll keep seeing companies just shifting over.
Well, the old adage is that markets don't like uncertainty, and neither do boardrooms of big corporations.
And for all the EU's boringness, I mean, it is relatively certain what's going on.
Absolutely,
any change just takes years to get through.
It's positively glacial, which is reassuring to those very same boardroom occupiers. Let's cross the body of water that separates us from North America. Today, Conservative speakers have been gathering in Maryland at the CPAC summit. Among them are the NRA's Vice President, Wayne LaPierre, who, to probably nobody's surprise, has recommended more guns in schools. If you're a school student in the US who disagrees, many will be heading to Washington to protest in a few weeks' time. You may have some difficulty making your voice heard in Texas. The superintendent of one school in Needville, a small town outside of Houston, has drawn criticism for telling students the district will not allow a student demonstration during school hours for any type of protest or awareness. Interesting final addition to that. Oscar, sure, disrupting the school day, never popular by administrators. But is that sort of rhetoric and that sort of behaviour the way we would expect the US to approach issues which actually start to be more about free speech than about gun control?
Look, I don't want to lampoon the suggestion of a thought crime made in Texas. But of course, what you have here is a confusion between two amendments of the Constitution. I mean, the first confusion is, of course, with the Second Amendment, which most people think is, just about an abstract right to bear arms. In fact, that, of course, is connected with the revolutionary history of the country. It has to do with the fact that the founding fathers didn't want a stable army, but rather people to continue to have the means for self-defense. And that has been turned into this blanket allowance for people to have all sorts of assault rifles and so on and so forth, and ditto with the First Amendment. And now the very question of bearing an arm and so on is being turned into a political issue that has been poisoned, particularly after the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court. All of a sudden, freedom of speech in America is the freedom to speak by those who have the most money. And that's, you have this sort of, poisoning on both sides. And that makes things very, very complicated. It wasn't just Napier saying more guns. This was exactly President Trump's reaction. More guns to certain teachers in the schools. So, if this continues to go this way, we'll have shootouts in schools. I have to say I'm quite a skeptical about the possibility of these debate becoming more interesting or progressive voices gaining more respect. I know there is concern, but that concern has always been there. And, I wish that would happen. But with the people who are in power right now, I don't think so.
I fear I share your scepticism or even cynicism about that, probably, Oscar. And just on Lapierre, it was interesting talking about the sort of reinterpretation of some of these sacrosanct rights as we are presented them from the Constitution. He said today, the right to bear arms is not bestowed by man, but granted by God. That was literally what he said, which perhaps speaks...
Look, I mean, if you're making a political point and you think you're making a political point because God told you so, well, we are, you know, we're in a different terrain, no longer democracy.
Well, indeed. And Joy, to that point, and Oscar sort of alluded to this already, the First and Second Amendments in particular, there's always this suggestion in the states that they... And there's always talk from politicians about a respect for the sentiment and the respect for the rights they guarantee. But, you know, they are open to interpretation or misinterpretation. Mm. And they have become... They're different from what they were set out to be by the Founding Fathers, surely.
Well, I think so. I mean, the right to express yourself freely. What's interesting is if you have students saying, I actually wish to protest for my rights... you're actually almost going against, you know, Donald Trump, who's created an environment where he says the media may not speak, the media is lying to you, the media should be, you know, curtailed, shut down. So they're in fact fighting for the Constitution. I always find the amendment on guns interesting because it says for the defence of a free state, you need a well-regulated militia and therefore you have the right to bear arms. And the well-regulated militia bit just seems to drop out of the conversation regularly. So that would imply an army. You could, in theory, turn the NRA into a well-regulated militia. And if they fail to regulate their members who have the guns, they that cease to be officially recognised and they're not allowed to bear guns. In theory, the gangs of Chicago could organise themselves into a well-regulated militia, have permission to do so, and again, lose their rights to do so. But because the amendments are being chosen very specifically just for the right to bear arms, they're not in fact being interpreted as they were originally written, and the intention is not there. So, yeah, meaning
fact,
has changed.
There is a great sketch on Saturday Night Live in which an armed member of the Black Panther Party speaks the NRA speech, and the other two white guys
Those rights weren't granted to you.
Exactly. It's the rights as we see fit. Well, just finally on this, and also, you are in a sense answered this already. There doesn't appear to be a centre ground between even some quite progressive liberal voices on this. And it has been pleasing to see the erudition of the young people who were affected, for example, in this most recent shooting, no question. But is there a centre ground between their erudition and their progressive views and the kind of predictable... I mean, it's a hysteric reaction almost from the right wing in the US. But there isn't a centre ground, is there?
The marvellous way in which you just put it, there is a disconnect between the people who are clearly much more enlightened than their rulers. If you heard this very articulate father who talked during the meeting with Donald Trump, incredibly contained. I mean, I would be furious. I would be, you know, jumping at this guy. And he articulated their position in such a calm and illustrious manner. You would expect a certain, a response of more or less the same kind. And all you get is these cliches, this idea that God is telling you to bear arms, which, I mean, in what interpretation of, Christianism that makes any sense? And President Trump giving all the wrong signals once more. Why? Because, of course, what is behind this is powerful plaintiffs, powerful the base, the NRA, and so on and so forth. So nobody wants to take this discussion seriously, certainly not the politicians.
There's a sobering thought for you. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, Joy Ladiko and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Coming up next, why Brazil's military are now running the streets of Rio.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto and New York City. In New York City, our bureau chief is Ed Stocker.
You really can be anyone you want to be in New York. You can dress exactly how you like. You can act exactly how you like. There's that tolerance and acceptance that I think perhaps doesn't exist quite like it does in New York in any other city in the world. There's an energy and excitement to living here, and that's what makes it a great place to work in and to also live.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Twenty minutes past the hour here in London. You're back with Midori House. Still with me, Oscar Guardiola-Rivera and Joy Lodico. Now, the Brazilian military took over control of duties normally handled by Rio's police force last Friday in an effort to curb crime. Earlier this week, the move was ratified in the country's legislature, and the extreme measure arrives due to claims from the likes of Brazil's president, Michel Temer. He says the city has been virtually taken over by gangs. Oscar, it's not the first time cities or states in Brazil have come under temporary or military rule of this type. And yet, you know, I find it almost astonishing that there's so little reaction to this in a country where, of course, you know, it's only a generation ago that we had a dictatorship. How did it come to this?
I guess you just answer your own question. That is exactly how the coup took place back in 1964. If you look at your history between 1964 and 1968, two arguments were used. The first one was there is corruption. All the politicians are corrupt. And very quickly, this argument of corruption was directed against the left. And then after that, security. Our cities are being taken over by criminals. So all of a sudden, the military takes over the streets. Of course, there has always been a consistent presence of the military, particularly in the favelas. I mean, most people would not know this, that, of course, Brazil's so-called racial democracy has to be inverted, which is to say violence has continued to be directed against mostly black population who live in the poorer conditions in the favelas. But now we're seeing, and this is the important difference, the very houses of Congress allowing for that kind of violence to flood the city. And I have to say, it isn't a coincidence that this is happening in the midst of persecution against the left. As most of your listeners would remember, Lula da Silva has been condemned on very shaky evidence. It's very likely that he will not be allowed to step as a candidate. And he's the most popular politician in the country. And all of a sudden, just before the election comes, you bring the military onto the street. I'm sorry, but this is not a coincidence, and it should not be interpreted as a coincidence. And the very idea that the real reason behind this is a spike in crime rates in Rio de Janeiro is laughable. Of course, there is a crime in the streets of Rio. There has always been. But in no self-respecting democracy, it would occur to any politician that the best way to deal with that is by militarizing your streets.
And Joy, I wonder, is there a bit of a problem here, which is that where there is a vacuum politically in the political classes, and of course one of the problems in Brazil is that there is seemingly virtually nobody who is not being tainted by corruption or allegations of corruption, where that political vacuum, even if there's a lack of political personality, you then get the environment within which these sorts of moves can happen. Is it a political crisis, I guess, as much as anything else? A purely political crisis?
Is it a political crisis? Well, I don't know. I don't know this situation as well as Oscar, but actually I was looking at it numerically and it looked like an economic crisis to me. And you know, what was interesting is Brazil had grown, just fractionally, its GDP had risen, but actually Rio's had fallen. And it was just enough to kind of, it was about 100,000 official jobs and presumably many more that had disappeared. It was companies beginning to move out. It was the cost of the infrastructure for the Olympics, which meant that a certain amount of money wasn't moving around the city in the way it should have done. Now, I don't know Brazil as well as you do, so you may wish to contradict me here, but it showed that how fragile a city is in terms of an ecology, that it does need certain things to keep it going. Now, whether the military coming onto the streets is the correct answer, I'm not entirely sure, but there is something that is not functioning there, that is sick, and there's clearly a huge amount of kind of corruption and lack of trust in political structures. That means, who's in charge?
Actually, for someone who doesn't read with much pleasure the Venus Standard every single day, I have to say I'm in complete agreement with you on that respect. Absolutely. The ecology, the already fragile ecology of Brazil's society was damaged, perhaps for a very long time, by the, and let's use the proper words here, by the coup d'etat that took place less than 2 years ago. And it has continued to deteriorate. So you see, it's not just, of course, in Rio, you see the economic signs, you see the jobs going down, and immediately you have a spike on crime. Totally understandable. You don't have to be a historical materialist to put those two together. You see that kind of violence also elsewhere in the sort of Brazilian rural areas. But in the rural areas is the ongoing genocide against indigenous peoples. So, but if you look at the forest, not just the trees, you see that the whole ecology, the forest, to continue to use your metaphor, is burning. And if that is the case, then of course the solution cannot be to bring even more fire into the stage.
Just briefly before we move on that, Oscar, it seems to me that the Brazilian, well, or cariocas or whatever you want to call it, seem remarkably, to my way of looking at it, sanguine though about the development. Am I mistaken to see a seemingly extraordinary lack of protest or dissatisfaction with this development?
Well, what my sources on the ground tell me, and I'm about to travel to Brazil in less than a month to see it for myself, is that there is a lot of fear. It's not just your usual, middle upper classes being very sanguine about this, which they have always been, because, again, the racial class divisions there mean that, if a fascist elite troops are continue to kill black drug dealers in the favelas, they don't tend to care that much. They began to care when they saw that during the 2013 protests, that kind of violence was also directed towards their sons and daughters who were protesting in the streets. Now, there is this division, of course. There is this division, there is deep political polarization. But I have to say that for the majority of Brazilians, it is clear that the Temer government is illegitimate. I mean, we're talking about someone who is much less unpopular than Maduro in Venezuela, whom everyone, loves to criticize. And if that is the case, then the signs are there. If you put your military in the streets, you're also sending a message to the Brazilian population. And the Brazilian population are reading this message, and the word is fear.
Just before we wrap up the show, let's talk about the work of artist Santiago Sierra. It's been removed from the Arco Madrid Art Fair. Sierra's works included photographs of jailed Catalan politicians who refer to themselves as political prisoners. Madrid, in response to outcry at the removal, claims in Spain there are no political prisoners. Joy, another conundrum for us to look at. Why were the images removed? And I wonder, in a quick overview of it, does anyone on either side have a valid point here?
Well, I'm not sure they do, actually. And as I gather it was the art fair that took its own decision to remove them. Those in charge said there's absolutely no reason to do so. And in fact, actually, they'd removed them because they said it's distracting from the other works of art. They've now become a cause célèbre. They're, being reported on BBC. I'm not quite sure what the Spanish think, or this art fair thinks art is, if it is not indeed to disrupt in some way. And if there is a subject that is going to disrupt and capture attention at the moment, it's the situation in Catalonia.
Indeed. And Oscar, briefly, we talked earlier in the programme about the idea of free expression and its importance. I mean, presumably an artist's raison d'etre needs to be to say or to express whatever he or she likes, regardless of any consequences.
I'm afraid this was a total cock-up on the part of Arco. There is no art that isn't political.
And particularly, no good art,
exactly,
certainly.
And particularly the case with contemporary art. Contemporary artists are becoming much better at making political points than philosophers and writers who have become way too soft and moderate. So it makes no sense to withdraw this work. Of course there are political prisoners in Spain. Everybody knows that. They are political prisoners. They were imprisoned precisely because of a certain political view. One may not agree with that political view, but to turn that into an argument against a certain artistic object is nonsense.
There you go. Wise words, as always, from Oscar Guardiola Rivera and from Joy Ladico. My thanks to both of them for joining us on Midori House. Today, the programme was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Louis Hartnett O'Mara, and our studio manager was Christy Evans. My name's Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for tuning in.